This is case number 50560, Hubert Draw versus State. Mr. Pickter for the appellant, Ms. Lucic for the respondent. Mr. Pickter.
Thank you, Mayor. Please, court.
Do you want to reserve some time on this?
Yes, please. I will be reserving 5 minutes.
Okay.
May it please the court, justices, counsel. My name is Mark Pickter. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Hubert Draw. We have raised three discrete issues within the brief and the appeal in this matter, and I'll address each of them very briefly. I think they've been adequately spelled out for you, but we'll add a couple of things. The first issue that we raised was as to the improper closing argument, which prejudiced Mr. Draw during trial. As a result of the inflammatory and golden rule arguments that we believe were made during the course of the closing argument, Mr. Draw suffered great harm in that it served to, in effect, do a reverse jury nullification. We hear a lot about jury nullification. This was a reverse jury nullification. It was, these girls were brave, they came before you, they didn't have to, so you should feel sorry for them and you should, you know, give them more credit than they deserve.
Well, Ms. Lucic didn't use those words.
No, but she did use words that, as the respondents have put in their brief, they talked about inferences, and those are fair inferences that can be drawn by the jury, by the things that they said. One of which was, you know, that they didn't have to come. Well, certainly they did have to come. They were under a court order to come. That's what a subpoena is. It is a court order that they must come or they face criminal charges. So for the state to be arguing in its brief and to have argued at trial that they didn't have to come is disingenuous. That's not the case. Plus the fact, what it ignores is what's in the record and what was in the transcripts is that these two girls were still under supervision from Child Protective Services here in Clark County. We know that because one of the witnesses that the state put on was the social worker who was working with them and was supervising them. So we know that there's a variety of reasons why they had to come. They weren't, and as we know from the record also, we know that they ran away before they could be placed into a foster home. They left town. They had to be found, and brought back, also within the record. So when the state argued that they came back, that they are here, you know, because they just, the only reason they're here is to tell the truth, and that's the only reason they came back to face you, that's a disingenuous argument. As to the golden rule argument, the respondents have argued that our reliance on, and I never know how to pronounce this one, so I'll just go the best I can, of the Leos versus Cohen decision.
Leos?
Well, I was close. Thank you, Justin. Is that our reliance on that is misplaced because it's a civil case. Well, but I note in reading that case and looking at the cases that this court relied upon in ruling Leos, didn't just rely on civil cases. What this court did was say, okay, attorney misconduct is attorney misconduct. If you overstep the bounds, we don't say it's okay in the criminal offense side, but it's not okay in the civil side. That's not what this court was saying. This court was laying down a bright line rule that when you cross the line in these kind of arguments and you ask the jury to put themselves in the shoes of a victim, whether they're a plaintiff in a civil side or a victim in a criminal side, you are crossing the line and that's improper argument. So we believe that our reliance on Leos is certainly justified, but we went beyond that. We cited Valdez and we talked about how that applies, and we talked about how the golden rule is not allowed and its reference there. In addition, what I noted for you in conclusion in that argument is that when it's a close case, and this is what this court talked about in the cumulative effect of errors citation from Valdez, is that even more recently in in the Freeman versus Davidson case that this court decided in 1989, when evidence is sharply contradicted, the error is treated as being more significant. So in a close case, which this case obviously was by the fact that the jury came back with 6 not guilty verdicts, and then was undecided, I believe, on another, another seven charges. We know that from that, this is a closed case. So the evidence is something, so the evidence is closed, so then this court has to look at those errors that may have just tipped it barely to one side or the other, because it's not an overwhelmingly guilt case. In the second argument that we made, we were addressing the delay of bringing
this. Can I ask you a question about that, counsel? You suggest that there was undue delay and that we should do an analysis that deals with the presumptively prejudicial length of time that it took this to get to trial, the burger, if you will. Isn't it true that of the 6 times that this case was continued, you and your client were responsible for those delays or, in fact, requested continuances?
I would disagree with you. What I would say is Mr. Draw's counsel certainly did request those delays. But if you will note, Mr. Draw, from the beginning, invoked his right to his trial within 60 days. The only
Don't
time
you waive
ever,
that once you ask for a continuance thereafter?
He was only asked on the record, and the record is empty of any other agreements by Mr. Draw to any of these continuances or even knowledge of these continuances. There is only one place on the record where that exists, and that is on the day of the trial was supposed to begin, April 3rd, 2007, when his two attorneys at that time walked in and said, yes, we've been representing, and I want to make sure I get the timeline right, we've been representing Mr. Draw since the arraignment on July 26, 2006. Here we are on April 3rd, 2007, and we have not met with Mr. Draw, nor have we met with any of the witnesses.
And then he also suffered, allegedly, a mild heart attack. So some of these continuances or delays were with good cause, I might suggest.
Well, at least, and I will agree with you, Your Honor, there is at least some that may have good cause. The problem is that the record is empty of any establishment of that. What we've got is his counsel requests continuances, a number of which have no reference to whether Mr. Draw agrees or doesn't agree with him. The only time he agrees with that continuance is on April 3rd when Judge Gates says to him, I'm going to fire these attorneys, I'm going to name the public defender's office, but we need to continue the trial date. And he says, I guess that's right.
I beg to differ with you. At the request of the first continuance, in fact, he was canvassed with respect to whether or not he understood that by seeking that continuance, he would be waiving his right to go to trial within 60 days.
Well, Your Honor, I understand what you're saying, and I guess to some extent I disagree with what the tenor of that hearing is, because ask him if he understands, not if he agrees to it. But second of all, even granted that may absolutely be, that arguably that's true, that's the first continuous. And thereafter, we still have until, August 21st, 2007, when this trial begins. So there are a number of other continuances where he is not canvassed, that he is not present for. So, Your Honor, I don't want to argue that the record isn't what it is, because it certainly reflects that. But I will note that Mr. Draws is, at least in that spot, is between a rock and a hard place, because he's trying to give his attorneys time to do their job. The problem is they don't even do their job.
And if we hadn't given him time, we would be seeing this on a different issue, perhaps that infamous ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
Well, Your Honor, we're here on direct appeal.
I understand that.
You still may see it on that issue. I don't want to foreclose that from being a possibility. The third issue that we raised, Your Honors, is the idea that insufficiency of evidence. And I understand that would be considered, out of these three arguments, the weakest, because the law presumes that the jury has done its job, the jury has properly weighed the evidence, and those kind of things. But I think once you get to the mixed verdict, which we know that the only corroborating evidence, and I understand one of the arguments the state's going to make is that the victim doesn't have to be corroborated, her uncorroborated testimony is enough, and that works for Monet. The jury didn't believe Maya, apparently, because they acquitted on all of her charges, yet the corroboration for anything that Monet said came from Maya's mouth. So they believed Maya on one side, but didn't believe her on the other side, but they believed Monet. It's very confusing, and in fact, that was part of the issue that was raised in the motion for new trial. So I believe that given all of the circumstances, we're in a situation where the sufficiency of evidence needs to be examined pretty closely based on the closeness of the evidence, and I'll reserve the rest.
Okay, you have 4 minutes and 53 seconds left. Ms. Lucic, on behalf of the State of Nevada Clark County District Attorney,
good afternoon, Justices. As you all know, my name is Lisa Luzich, and I was trial counsel. In fact, I was counsel from the very beginning of the case, from the defendant's first appearance in arraignment. And with all due respect to counsel, I believe that the court shouldn't even be considering most of his first argument, as almost none of the comments that were made in closing argument were objected to. And because they were not objected to, they are therefore waived on appeal. That being said, I would submit to the court that I properly argued the evidence and the reasonable inferences that could be drawn from that evidence in my closing argument. Counsel first talked about the comment that I made about that these girls didn't have to come. The fact that they came here and faced the jury demonstrates how sincere they are. And counsel is 100% incorrect. They lived in New Jersey. I have absolutely no subpoena power in New Jersey.
And in fact, Lucic, didn't they live at that time with their father, which was the suggestion that was made for the fabrication of their testimony?
That is correct. They were living with their father in New Jersey. And half of that is because at the time these allegations arose, the mother sided with the defendant, and CPS, therefore, took the children out of the home and said, you know, if you want your kids back, you need to protect your kids. And she refused. She voluntarily gave up custody of her children. So they went to their dad in New Jersey. So in New Jersey, I can make a phone call and say, I have a subpoena, please come. And if they say no, I'm done. Then I have to go and get a compelling order from our court. I have to take it to New Jersey, hope that the DAs in New Jersey will help me get into a court in New Jersey, and that's a long involved process. So when I say that they're here because they want to be here, that is an accurate statement. It is not in any way disingenuous or false. I have done material witness warrants in front of all of you justices as trial courts, and I have compelled people to come to court. In that kind of situation, I would never make that argument in closing, but in this argument, it was completely a reasonable and accurate argument to make. As far as the other statements I made about golden rule, those were not golden rule violations. If I had said, imagine, sit, if you would, in the head of the victim as she was laying under him while he's pounding away at her, now that would be putting yourself putting the jury in the shoes of the victim. But what the defense was in this entire case is that these young girls, Monet and Maya, were scheming, and they were doing everything they can to make up this huge story so that they could get away from their mother and move in with their dad. I was pointing out that imagine what it's like for a 14-year-old girl to be in a position where her mother doesn't believe her, her father is thousands of miles away, she is unsafe, she wants to do the right thing, she comes forward and her mother doesn't believe her. She has to go to the police. She goes through interviews. She has to come out. She has to be cross-examined, not only at preliminary hearing, but then again at trial. I mean, that is something very difficult for a 14 and younger child to deal with.
And there was no objection to that anyway, right?
And there was not.
See, that puts us in a real strange position because that means that the trial judge doesn't have a chance to correct it if, in fact, it is error. Because there's no objection, the trial judge is left just with letting the argument go forward. So it puts us in a very tenable position.
Which is why I made the first argument that you shouldn't consider it. However, if you choose to, I would argue
that. But we'd have to consider it as plain error. And again, we always like to give the trial judges a chance to correct, if they think there's an error, to correct it by an instruction or by informing the jury of something orally.
You know, trial judges can also interpose their own objections sua sponte. It's done on occasion when they believe prosecutors are saying something improper and inform the jury that that was improper to disregard it. And the judge did not do that in this particular case. So I would submit that the judge did not himself think it was an improper argument either.
Let me ask you, Ms. Lucy, I mean, the statement that, you know, we flagged the argument, it's just this sentence here. Imagine how just dirty it makes you feel. So you're saying you don't feel that's
I'm sorry, imagine how...
The quote we have from the transcript is, imagine how just dirty it makes you feel. When you made the argument, the previous sentence was, how embarrassing first to have to go through these acts, to have your father figure doing these things to you. The next sentence is, imagine how just dirty it makes you feel.
But I continued, you didn't get the whole quote, how dirty it makes you feel and how embarrassing it is to come in and have to talk to 12, 14 strangers about these intimate details. The defense argued in their closing argument that you can't believe these girls, they didn't cry, they weren't emotional, and I know that they generally are not, that by the time a victim hits the stand in a trial, so much time has passed, they've had to explain to so many different people, the first responding police officer, the detective, a nurse or doctor if there's an examination, the DA at a pretrial, then cross-examination and direct at a prelim, and then again at trial. They've explained it so many times that very often, by the time there's a trial, there's a flat affect. Different people react differently to different situations. A jury expects somebody who has been sexually assaulted, especially a child, when they're talking about it, to burst into tears. So I just try to counteract that by saying, imagine how bad they feel, how dirty they feel, how embarrassed they are to have gone through this and then have to explain it to strangers. So I suggest that that is not a golden rule argument, that that is proper comment and a reasonable inference, especially in light of invited error. When a defense attorney makes an argument like, they didn't cry, they weren't emotional, you can't believe them, I need to be able to fix that.
Would you comment on, Ms. Picker mentioned that this, at least in his opinion, this was a closed case. Was it a closed case? In other words, tell me what you had that would either make it a closed case or not a closed case.
You know what, unfortunately, most of our sex cases are closed cases. Very, very rarely does anybody molest a child on video. Very, very rarely does anybody molest a child in front of witnesses. Very, very rarely are there physical findings in any sexual situation, and especially in this case, most of it was over the clothes type touching. There were two counts of sexual assault that were digital penetration. There would not be any physical findings. There would not be any DNA evidence. So 99% of my cases generally rest on the victim, and that I also suggest is why the no corroboration instruction has come about. But it rests on the victim. And that's the problem with when a case is on review at the Supreme Court, all you have are cold hard transcripts. You don't get to see the kids testify. You don't get to feel whatever emotion there is. You don't get to see the body language, all of those things that the jury sees. So is it a closed case? Well, unfortunately, of course it was a closed case because there isn't anything like fingerprints, DNA, independent witnesses, but they were very credible witnesses, and I would point out it's unfortunate that the minutes weren't very accurate. When the judgment for acquittal, the motion for judgment of acquittal was filed, when Judge Gates made his ruling, he denied it because he said that the girls were very credible. Now, did they acquit on Maya's count? Sure they did. She was the one who cried. She was the one who was emotional. But when you have a child who once testifies under oath that it didn't happen, and then once testifies under oath that it did happen, you can believe her that it did happen, but simply the fact that once before she said under oath it didn't, that necessarily creates reasonable doubt. When they find him not guilty, they're not saying he didn't do it. They're just saying that the state did not prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. So I would suggest that, yes, Maya did corroborate Monet, but also Monet's friend and the father, who she disclosed to, also corroborated Monet on top of her very credible testimony. Defense counsel makes comment about the fact that there was some not guilties, some hung, and some guilties, and that necessarily means that the evidence is conflicting or the jury was illogical, and that's not true because it demonstrates, in fact, that the jury was hardworking and what they did made a lot of sense. When you break it down, the way the counts were charged were by age of child, and then age of child, and then conduct. Maya's three counts, not guilty, you know, obviously the one time she testified it did, the one time she testified it didn't. Monet, there were 17 counts. There were the two sexual assaults, and when she sexual assault under 16, but she testified that and at preliminary hearing and at trial, her testimony was completely consistent that he put his finger in her vagina once or twice, that when he put it in, he moved it around, it didn't go all the way in. So she was very descriptive, but she said once or twice. Now, once or twice is absolutely sufficient evidence for a bindover because it's just slight or marginal evidence. But once or twice for the second count to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, it's very reasonable that the jury gave the defendant the benefit of the doubt on the second count. It absolutely happened once. Maybe it happened again. So they gave him the benefit of the doubt. So it was one guilty on the sexual assault and one not guilty. The eight counts of open and gross lewdness regarding Monet, they found guilty of, there were eight of them, they found him guilty of seven of them, not guilty of the one count where she testified that he rubbed his genital area against her genital area. She had testified that he was never naked during these incidents, that he always had boxers on. Now, as a prosecutor, I know that it does not have to be skin-to-skin contact. Unfortunately, shame on me, I didn't argue that. So the jury very reasonably could have believed that because there was not skin-to-skin contact, that it was not a criminal charge, open and gross lewdness, which would reasonably explain that one not guilty. There were six counts of lewdness with a minor regarding Monet. Four of them were hung. Two were not guilty. The elements of lewdness with a minor are that there was a touching, that there was sexual intent, and that she was under 14. Remember, these incidents took place over the course of time. And when she testified about when these things happened, you know, kids never remember. Well, it happened on September 3rd of 2007. They remember things like, well, you know, I was in the sixth grade, or, you know, you try to relate it to Susie's birthday party or something like that. It was unclear whether some of the counts happened when she was actually under 14 or not. Also, it is very possible that they believed that the conduct occurred, but there was not sexual intent. Some of the counts were that he would, like, rub her boobs and say, oh, look, you're getting kind of loose, or you need to get in shape, rub her butt. I believe that that is sexual intent, but it's possible that the jury did not. So it is very reasonable that they were hung on some of those and two were not guilty, that they did not convict him of those. So what they did makes total sense when you look at it that way. You don't have to look at it as it's all or nothing. It's not all guilty or all not guilty. You have to take each count one by one, and it's very obvious that the jury did that in this case. They worked hard, and they came up with what they believed to be a proper solution. And then finally, as far as the delay, I would point out, with all due respect to the defense, that the delay was entirely the defendant's fault. He invoked his right to a speedy trial. His attorneys were not ready. The state was ready. He was asked, when they asked to continue that first time, do you understand that you're waiving your right to a speedy trial? He said yes. And he was asked if he wanted to do that. And he said yes. Once he waives his right to a speedy trial, he doesn't have that right any longer. The next few continuances, the defense attorneys needed more time. He never objected. If he had objected to the trial being continued, it would have been contained in the minutes. He did not, and it was not contained in the minutes. But it was also his fault in that he was causing the problem with the attorneys. He was refusing to meet with them. There was actually a trial set back in March of 2008, we actually got set to start trial. I flew my witnesses in from New Jersey. I flew five people in from New Jersey. I put them up at hotels. I fed them. I pre-trialed them. The defense attorneys were calling me after the calendar call during the week saying he's refusing to cooperate with us. He's refusing to meet with us. I'm like, look, be ready. We're going. And then on Monday, we went into chambers, and they explained to Judge Gates, and we did it on the record, that he was absolutely refusing to participate. His family members, who were supposed to be witnesses, were refusing to participate. They said that they couldn't go forward like that. I argued, no, let's go forward anyway. They're ready. They've done their work. If he's not going to cooperate, that's his fault. But Judge Gates, instead, over my objection, vacated the trial date and relieved them as attorneys. So that delay was all caused by them. I twice asked for a continuance, once because the detective, who is an essential witness, was unavailable. She was out of state. And at the same time, Monet was going to summer school in Detroit. And she was with family in Detroit, her mother's family, in fact. And I was not going to say, hey, you know, the summer school is a very short time. If you miss 3-4 days, you may not be able to complete the course. I didn't want her to not complete the course. I thought that was good cause to continue the trial, and I asked. Then there was one time that I was physically in a trial that was still going. It went way longer than it should have, and therefore I couldn't go the next week. And when you are involved with these kids for the time that I have, I'd spent all the time with them pre-prelim, I'd spent all the time that first trial setting, pre-trial them. It's not fair to them to hand it off to just somebody else at the very last minute. So I believe that that was good cause as well. There was no prejudice to the defendant at all. He had been out of custody since November of 2006. Actually, before that, he bailed out around October of 2006, and all of his witnesses were available, as demonstrated by the fact that they testified at his actual trial. So he was not prejudiced in any way. He caused almost all of the delay. So I think it's disingenuous of them to ask that the case be reversed on those grounds. And unless the court has any questions, I would ask the court to sustain the conviction. Thank you.
Mr. Picker? You have 4 minutes and 53 seconds in rebuttal.
Thank you. Addressing the final issue that the state talked about first, it's interesting that the majority of that argument is not contained anywhere in the record. Most of the facts that she just stated are her own personal belief and information. But going beyond that, the fact is that the attorneys went in and on April 3rd and said, we are not ready. We haven't had a chance to meet with Mr. Draw. We haven't had a chance to meet with his witnesses. Now, whether Ms. Lozanich wants to say something different is fine, but that's what's on the record and that's what's before you. So start with that. Second of all, dealing with the golden rule argument, and let's just talk about the one that was sustained. The statement, which is on page 204 of the appendix, which is, their mother has called them a liar. Their mother doesn't want them. Their mother chose a man over them. Mr. Menino objects. The objection is sustained. And what is Ms. Luzesa's response to that? It is, I didn't say the mother didn't want them. Well, that's exactly what she said. What she did was she repeated it again so the jury could hear it by making that argument yet again. I didn't really say that. I meant this. Well, that's fine, except that it's a repeat of the same golden rule argument. It's an inflammatory argument in that Mrs. Draw was given two choices. Abandon your husband, abandon your children. One or the other. That's what the testimony was at trial. That's what the testimony was from the social worker. She had two choices. She chose to stand by her husband during the course of this criminal investigation. And that's what the state used as their statement as, she doesn't want the children. She's not interested in the children. And as I said, their mother doesn't want them is exactly the statement that was made, and that's on page 204 of the appendix. In the state's brief, it is replete with the same kind of arguments that I just said they made, and they're denying they made. Things like, the state explained that the two teenage victims would not voluntarily disclose embarrassing details. This is exactly the kind of argument that this court said in Lioche. You can't keep vouching for your victims. You can't keep talking about them and propping them up. Those kind of things are inappropriate. So not only is it in Lioche, page 983 and 984, but under Supreme Court Rule 173, that was improper argument then. It was, you can't keep saying, look at this from their perspective. There's no, okay, let's see here. There's a number of statements about the alienation from the family. That what happens is that the state keeps saying, kids wouldn't do this. And in fact, she said it again to you here. I know that that they are not generally, they are generally not hysterical. That's what she just said to you 5 minutes ago, is that, and she's telling you, I know they aren't. How come you don't know that? And to the jury, I'm telling you that they're not going to be hysterical. Because even though they're telling you the truth, they're not going to be hysterical. That's the kind of argument that is exactly crossing the line. Your Honor asked a very cogent question, and it was perfectly on point. It is that when at the point where these kids, these two girls, had to come back from New Jersey, they were living with their father, which is what they wanted all along. What's the prejudice to Mr. Draw and the delay? The prejudice to him is these two girls are living with the very man and their grandmother, their natural father and their grandmother, who coached them on this scheme to raise these allegations. And the longer they live there, the more they're indoctrinated. And that's
counsel, what evidence do you have of coaching and indoctrination?
Those are the allegations that were made during in the course of the testimony by Mike Draw and by the family members. And
wait, the evidence
also
will show that while they were in New Jersey with Dad during the delay,
yes,
they were coached and indoctrinated?
No.
Represented, counsel.
No, I'm not, Your Honor. That's not what I was saying. I was saying they had the time to be coached and indoctrinated, and that is the case. That's one of those prejudices to him. Specifically, Monet's friends, you know, the state talks about her friend and the father corroborated her testimony, but the friend was admittedly not a close friend. It's one she picked, and that was the allegation that was made during trial. She picked that girl as a place where she could go to make those allegations. Her best friends, the people who she identified as best friends, and they identified themselves as her best friends, they all testified that she was making these things up, and that she had gotten this information, and this is how she could get out of the house. So that's where I come with that. And I apologize if it sounded like if I was saying that there was evidence. No, there wasn't. But I'm saying that's the prejudice in that period of time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Picker.
Thank you.
Thanks to both Ms. Luce and Mr. Picker for their arguments in this case. This case will stand submitted, Ms. Cummings, and we'll be at ease until we have the next case.